the gods again taunt us with a radiant sunset. Nothing should be this beautiful, I quietly say to Chu. The gods are playing tricks on us. How could they be so cruel and still make the sky so lovely? My words tug at my heart. It is unfair of the gods to show us beauty when I am in so much pain and anguish. I want to destroy all the beautiful things. Don't say such things, or the spirits will hear, Chu warns me. I don't care what she says. This is what the war has done to me. Now I want to destroy because of it. There is such hate and rage inside me now. The Ankar has taught me to hate so deeply that I now know I have the power to destroy and kill. Soon, darkness covers the land, and still Pa has not returned. We sit on the steps waiting for him, together in silence. No words are exchanged as our eyes search the fields waiting for him to come home. We all know that Pa will not return, but no one dares to say it out loud, for it will shatter our illusion of hope. With darkness, the flies disappear and the mosquitoes appear to feast on our flesh. Ma holds Gek in her arms. Every once in a while, Ma's arms fan Gek's body to chase away the mosquitoes. As if picking up on Ma's pain, Gek kisses her cheek softly and caresses her hair.
Ma, where's Pa? Gek asks,
but Ma only responds with silence.
Go inside, all you kids.
Go inside,
Ma tells us in a tired voice. You should come in with us. We can all wait inside, Chu says to her.
No. I'd rather wait out here and greet him when he returns.
Chu takes Gek from Ma and goes into the hut. Keem and I follow her, leaving Ma sitting on the steps by herself, waiting for Pa to return. Listening to Gek and Chu breathing softly, my eyes stay wide open. After he hid from the soldiers for 20 months, they finally found him. Pa always knew he couldn't hide forever. I never believed he couldn't. I cannot sleep. I worry about Pa and about us. What will become of us? We have taken our survival for granted. How will we survive without Pa? My mind races and fills my head with images of death and executions. I have heard many stories about how the soldiers kill prisoners and then dump their bodies into large graves, how they torture their captives, behead them, or crack their skulls with axes so as not to waste their precious ammunition. I cannot stop thinking of Pa, and whether or not he died with dignity. I hope they did not torture him. Some prisoners are not dead when they are buried. I cannot think of Pa being hurt this way, but images of him clawing at his throat, fighting for air as the soldiers pile dirt on him flood my mind. I cannot make the pictures go away. I need to believe Pa was killed quickly. I need to believe they did not make him suffer. Oh, Pa, please don't be afraid. The images play over and over again in my head. My breath quickens as I think about Pa's last moment on Earth. Stop thinking. Stop or you'll die, I hiss to myself. But I cannot stop. Pa told me once that the really old monks could leave their bodies and travel the world as spirits. In my mind, my spirit leaves my body and flies around the country, looking for Pa. I see a big group of people kneeling around a big hole. There are already many dead people in the hole, their bodies sprawled on top of each other. Their black pajama clothes are soaked with blood, urine, feces, and small white matter. The soldiers stand behind the new group of prisoners, casually smoking a cigarette with one hand, while the other holds onto a big hammer, with clumps of hair sticking to its head. A soldier leads another man to the edge of the hole. My heart howls with agony. It's Pa! No! The soldier pushes on Pa's shoulders, making him kneel like the others. Tears stream out of my eyes as I whisper thanks to the gods that the soldier has blindfolded Pa. He is spared from having to see the executions of many others. Don't cry, Pa. I know you are afraid,
I want to tell him. I feel his body tense up, hear his heart race, see tears flowing out from under the blindfold. Pa fights the urge to scream as he hears the sound of a hammer crack the skull next to him, smashing into it. The body falls on top of the others with a thump. The other fathers around Pa cry and beg for mercy, but to no avail. One by one, each man is silenced by the hammer. Pa prays silently for the gods to take care of us. He focuses his mind on us, bringing up our faces one by one. He wants our faces to be the last things he sees as he leaves the earth. Oh, Pa, I love you. I will always miss you. My spirit cries and hovers down over him. My spirit wraps invisible arms around him, making him cry even more. Pa, I will always love you. I will never let you go. The soldier walks up to Pa, but I will not let him go. The soldier cannot hear or see me. He cannot see my eyes burn into his soul. Leave my Pa alone! My eyes dare not blink as the soldier raises the hammer above his head. Pa, I whisper, I have to let you go now. I cannot be here and live. Tears wash across my body as I fly away, leaving Pa there by himself. Back in the hut, I slide next to Chu. She opens her arms and takes me in. Our bodies cradling each other, we cry. The cool air chills the beads of sweat on my skin, making my teeth chatter. Beside us, Keem holds on tight to Gek. Pa, I cannot bear to think that you struggled for breath lying on top of the others in that hole. I must believe the soldier took pity and used one of his bullets on you. I cannot breathe, Pa. I am sorry I had to let you go. My mind swirls with pain and anger. The pain grows larger in my stomach. The pain spasm convulses as if it is eating away my linings. Turning on my side, I dig my hands into my stomach and squeeze it violently to make the physical pain stop. Then the sadness surrounds me. Dark and black, it looms over me, pulling me deeper and deeper into it. And then it happens again. It is almost as if I am somewhere else for the moment, and I simply black out the part of me that feels emotion. It is as if I am alive, but not alive. I can still hear the faint noise of Ma's muffled cries outside, but I do not feel her pain. I do not feel anything at all. Ma is up before anyone else the next morning. Her face is all puffy. Her eyes are red and swollen shut. Chu gives Ma some of the very little food we have left, but she will not eat. I join them on the steps, daydreaming about our lives back in Phnom Penh when I was happy. I cannot allow myself to cry, because once I do, I will be lost forever. I have to be strong. By the third day, we all know that what we feared most has happened. Cave, and now Pa. One by one, the Khmer Rouge is killing my family. My stomach hurts so much I want to cut it open and take the poison out. My body shivers as if evil has entered it, making me want to scream, beat my hands against my chest and pull out my hair. I want to close my eyes and blank out again, but I don't know how to do it at will. I want my Pa here in the morning when I wake up. That night I pray to the gods. Dear gods, Pa is a very devout Buddhist. Please help my Pa return home. He is not mean and does not like to hurt other people. Help him return, and I will do anything you say. I will devote my entire life to you. I will believe in you always. If you cannot bring Pa home to us, please make sure they don't hurt him. Or please make sure Pa dies a quick death. Chu, I whisper to my sister. I am going to kill Pol Pot. I hate him, and I want to make sure he dies a slow and painful death. Don't say such things, or you will get hurt. I am going to kill him. I do not know what he looks like, but if Pol Pot is the leader of the Angkor, then he is the one responsible for all the miseries in our lives. I hate him for destroying my family. My hate is so strong it feels alive. It slithers and moves around in the pit of my stomach, growing bigger and bigger. I hate the gods for not bringing Pa back to us. I am a kid, not even 7 years old, but somehow I will kill Pol Pot. I don't know him, yet I am certain he is the fattest, slimiest snake on earth. I am convinced that there is a monster living inside his body. He will die a painful, agonizing death, and I pray that I will play a part in it. I despise Pol Pot for making me hate so deeply. My hate empowers and scares me, for with hate in my heart, I have no room for sadness. Sadness makes me want to die inside. Sadness makes me want to kill myself to escape the hopelessness of my life. Rage makes me want to survive and live, so that I may kill. I feed my rage with bloody images of Pol Pot's slain body being dragged in the dirt.
As long as we don't know for certain that your Pa is dead, I will always have hope that he is alive somewhere,
Ma declares to us the next morning. My heart hardens at her words, knowing I cannot allow myself the luxury of hope. To hope is to let pieces of myself die. To hope is to grieve his absence and acknowledge the emptiness in my soul without him. Now that I have accepted the truth, I worry about what will happen to Ma. She was very dependent on Pa. He had always been there to make things easier for her. Pa was raised in the country and was accustomed to hardship. In Phnom Penh, we had live-in housekeepers to do just about everything for us. Pa was our strength, and we all needed him to survive, especially Ma. He was good at surviving and knew best what to do for us. I hope Pa comes to me again tonight. I hope he visits me in my sleep and meets me in my dreams. I saw him last night. He wore his tan military uniform from the Lon Nol government. His face was once again round like the moon, and his body was soft. He was so real, standing next to me, big and strong, like he was before the war.
Pa!
I run to him, and he picks me up.
Pa, how are you? Did they hurt you?
Don't worry.
He tries to soothe me.
Pa, why did you leave us? I miss you so much it hurts my stomach. Why didn't you come and find me? Pa, when will you come and find us? If I go to the orphanage camp, will you be able to find me?
I rest my head on his shoulder.
Yes, I will.
He's my Pa, and if he says that he will find me, I know he will.
Pa, why does it hurt so much to be with you? I don't want to hurt. I don't want to feel.
I am sorry you are hurt. I have to go.
Hearing this, I grip his arms tighter, refusing to let go.
Pa, I miss you so much. I miss sitting on your lap like I did in Phnom Penh.
I have to go, but I will look after you always,
Pa says softly, putting me down on the ground. I hold on to his finger and beg him not to leave me.
No! No, stay! Pa, stay with us. Please don't leave. I miss you, and I am scared. What will happen to us? Where will you go? Take me with you.
Pa looks at me, his eyes brown and warm. I reach out my hands to him, but the farther I reach, the farther away he moves, until he fades away completely. My body fights to sleep when the sun shines through our door to tell us it is morning. I want to stay asleep forever, just so I can be with him. In the real world, I don't know when I will ever see Pa again. Slowly, I open my eyes with Pa's face still lingering in my vision. It is not the face of the gaunt old man the soldiers took away, but the face of the man I once thought was a god. It was during our trip to Angkor Wat that I first thought Pa was a god. I was only 3 or 4 years old then. With my hand in Pa's, we entered the area of Angkor Thom, one of the many temple sites there. The gray towers loomed large before us like stone mountains.
On each of the towers, giant faces with magnificent headdresses looked out in different directions over our land. Staring at the faces, I exclaimed, "Pa, they look like you! The gods look like you!" Pa laughed and walked me into the temple. My eyes could not leave those huge round faces with their almond-shaped eyes, flat noses, and full lips, all of Pa's features. Waking up, I try to hold on to these images of Pa, even as we resume our lives without him. Ma returns to the field, working 12 to 14 hours a day, and leaves Gek behind with Chu. With Gek toddling after us, Chu and I and the other children work in the gardens and do menial labor in the village. It has been over a month since Pa was taken away. Ma seems to have recovered and is trying to get on with her life, but I know I will never see her truly smile again. Sometimes late at night, I am awakened by the sound of Ma sobbing on the steps, still waiting for Pa. Her body slumped like an old woman, she leans against the door frame, her arms wrapped around herself. She looks out into the field at the path Pa once walked, crying and longing for him. We miss him terribly, and Gek, being so young, is the only one able to vocalize our loneliness by continuing to ask for Pa. I am afraid for Gek. She is 4 years old and has stopped growing because of malnutrition. I want to kill myself knowing that it was I who stole the food from her mouth that one night. "Your Pa will bring us lots of food when he returns," Ma tells Gek when she asks for Pa. The soldiers come to our village more and more often now. Each time they leave, they take fathers from the other families. They always come in pairs, though never the same pair twice, with their rifles and casual excuses. When they come, some villagers try to hide their fathers by sending them off to the woods or having them be conveniently gone. But the soldiers wait, standing around the chief's house, slowly smoking their cigarettes as if they have all the time in the world. After they finish the pack, they walk to their victim's hut, and loud cries and screams from inside follow. Then there's only silence. We all know they feed us lies about the fathers coming back the next morning. Still, there is nothing we can do to stop them. No one questions these disappearances. Not the chief, not the villagers, not Ma. I hate the soldiers now as much as I hate the Ankar and their leader Pol Pot. I etch their faces into my memory and plan for the day when I can come back and kill them. There have been rumors in the village that Pa was not killed in a Khmer Rouge mass execution. Rumors spread that the soldiers made Pa a prisoner on a faraway mountain and tortured him every day. But he survived and escaped to the top of the mountains. The soldiers, hunting for him, have not been able to catch him. People passing by our village say they have seen someone fitting Pa's description. They tell tales of Pa forming his own army, trying to recruit more soldiers to fight the Khmer Rouge. Upon hearing these rumors, Ma's face lights up and her eyes shine once again with hope. For a few days, she walks off to work with a little more life in her step, and even 12 hours later, the glimmer of a smile is still on her face. At night, she continuously fusses over our appearance, wiping the dirt off our faces, combing the knots out of our hair. She believes the stories wholeheartedly. If he has escaped, it will not be long now before he comes searching for us. Until we know for sure of his fate, we must never give up hope. Once again, she devotes herself to sitting on the steps, waiting for Pa's return. Weeks pass after we hear the rumors about Pa, and still he has not returned. I know Ma misses him, and believes he is alive somewhere. Eventually, she stops waiting for him, and tries once more to resume her life. Time passes slowly without Pa in our lives. Even with our own ration of food, our survival depends on our older brothers bringing more food to us each week. When Koi gets sick, coughing up blood, we are forced to fend for ourselves. Koi is a strong young man, but he pushes himself too hard at work. His work consists of constantly loading and unloading 100 kilograms of rice onto trucks to be sent to China. Meng also cannot come because the soldiers are keeping him busy with work. We are all very worried for them both. Life is hard without Pa.
People in the village look down on Ma because she is not good at field work. It is too dangerous to have friends, so she does not talk to anyone. The villagers also look down on her white skin and often make rude comments about lazy white people. To my surprise, Ma becomes a hard worker and is surviving without Pa. On the days when Ma is assigned to work with 15 other village women fishing for shrimp in nearby ponds, I go with her, leaving Chu behind with Gek. My job in the group includes fetching water for the shrimp catchers, helping untangle their nets, and separating the shrimp from weeds. Though hungry, we are not allowed to eat the shrimp we catch because it belongs to the village and must be shared with all. If anyone is caught stealing, the chief can publicly humiliate her, take away her possessions, and beat her. The punishments for such acts are grave, but our hunger does not allow this to stop us from sometimes stealing.
Luong, Ma calls me. I need some water. Come here.
She stands up and wipes her brows with her sleeve, leaving a trail of mud on her face. Scooping a coconut shell of water out of the bucket, I run over and hand it to her.
Here, she whispers. Give me your hand fast, while no one is looking.
Ma turns around and takes another careful look at the others to make certain we are not being watched. She quickly gives me a handful of baby shrimp as she takes the water cup from me.
Quick, eat them while no one is looking.
Without hesitation, I shove the raw, crawling baby shrimp into my mouth, shells and all. They taste of mud and rotten weeds.
Chew quickly and swallow, Ma tells me. Now you look out for me while I eat some. If anyone is looking, call me.
I see Ma in a very different light now, and have more pride in her strength. Somehow, one way or another, we find ways to stay alive. Ma's Little Monkey, April 1977. It is 2 years since the Khmer Rouge rolled into Phnom Penh with their trucks, 4 months since the soldiers took Pa away, and Keem became head of our household. It has been almost a year since we last heard from Meng and Khoi. New Year's has come and gone, making us all a year older. Gek is now 5, I am 7, Chu is 10, and Keem is 12. Now head of the household, Keem takes seriously Pa's words for him to look after us. At dawn each morning, he wakes before us and runs to the town square for our work assignment. At the hut, Ma gets us girls up and spends a few minutes with each of us. Before she is done combing Gek's hair and washing her face, Keem is back with the day's instructions. As I slowly rise from my slumber, he is already telling Ma where to go. After Ma's left for the fields, we all walk to the community garden together with Gek, clinging to Keem's back. Though Keem's face looks like a monkey more than ever, Ma has not called him by this nickname since they took Pa away. Now he is only Keem to us. A few miles down the road from our village, there is a cornfield. We have had a good rainy season this year, and the corn is ripe for picking. However much we fear the punishment for stealing, our desperation is too strong to stop us.
Why not, Ma? Keem argues. We work morning, noon, and night planting these crops, and now that they are ripe, we are told we can't eat them. We are all starving.
It is just too dangerous, Keem. You know what the soldiers will do to you if you get caught.
Ma, we are starving to death. Many people are dying in the village, yet the government trades our crops to buy guns to kill more people.
Shh, don't talk so loud. It is a crime to speak against the Angkor. If the soldiers hear you, they will take you away and kill you.
Ma, I am going to go and get us some corn tonight.
With a determined look, Keem has made his decision.
Be careful,
Ma says to him and turns away. Chu and I do not try to stop him from going either, even though we know it is dangerous. Pol Pot has many soldiers with guns and rifles guarding the cornfields every night. The soldiers have the right to punish thieves any way they see fit, killing them if they choose. Their power is so omnipotent that no one dares question their actions. However fearful I am, my hunger makes me want to go myself, but I do not have the strength or courage to actually do it. I hear tales that the soldiers rape the girls they catch stealing, no matter how young they are. When the sky grows dark, Keem picks up 2 bags,
straightens his 12-year-old body and leaves. Part of me is glad Keem is doing this, and my mouth salivates at the thought of the food he will bring back. I can almost taste it already. I cannot wait until he gets back. My stomach moans for sweet, juicy corn. Yet I also fear for Keem's safety. We have already lost Pa and Cave. I do not want to bury another member of our family. It is getting late, and Keem is not back yet. What could take him so long? I look at Ma, who is holding on to Gek for comfort. Chu sits by herself in the corner of the room, staring out into her own world. God, this cannot happen to me again. If you let my brother die, I will never forgive you. You could just go to hell, for I know there are no gods in the world now, I scream to the spirits in my mind. As if answering my call, Keem suddenly climbs into our hut. He is smiling and carrying 2 bags of fresh corn. I rush up to him and help him carry them into the house. Seeing Keem, Ma smiles and puts Gek down so that she can greet him. What happened? You took so long, we were worried to death, Ma says, as she ushers him in with her arm around his shoulders. Ma, it is so easy. I never knew stealing could be so easy. There is so much corn, and no one can guard all the fields at once. I must have eaten at least 5 ears raw. As Keem begins to tell Ma what he did, I edge myself closer and closer to the bags of corn. My nose inhales the aroma, and my eyes fixate on the yellow ears. I cannot wait to sink my teeth into it. Can I go with him next time, Ma? I am getting greedier and greedier with the thought that 2 of us can bring home more corn than Keem can by himself.
No, you are not to go with him, and that is final.
With those words, Ma goes outside to cook our corn on a fire we started earlier in the evening. She digs a hole for the corn under the fire and spreads the fire over the makeshift stove. With Pa and many of the fathers in the village gone, the soldiers patrol our huts less and less, so it is relatively safe. For the next couple of weeks, Keem continues to steal corn for us whenever we run out. Each time he leaves, we wait with fear and guilt for his return. Each night, it seems to take him longer and longer. Keem slings 2 empty bags over his shoulders and climbs down the steps of the hut. His knees buckle when he reaches the ground. Quickly, he straightens himself before anyone notices. He knows Ma and the girls are depending on him, so he has to be very strong for them. There is no need to make them any more frightened than they already are by letting us know how scared he really is. He tries to show them he is fearless, but each time he goes out on this mission, he is always afraid of losing his nerve. He wants to run back to the hut and never carry out this dangerous task again. But he has to. He has to take care of his family. He looks up at the sky and sees no stars. The clouds are moving furiously fast, blocking any moonbeams from touching the earth. Okay, he says under his breath. It's time to be brave. With that, he forces his feet to carry him away into the darkness. He knows Ma and the girl's eyes are still upon him, bearing down on his back, but he must not turn to look at them, lest his courage fail him. He jogs in quick little steps. He knows that not to be seen, he has to dart and hide from one bush to another, like the foxes hiding from the humans during a hunt. The thought almost makes him smile. The sky is very dark now, and the moisture in the air is turning into a thick fog. It is good luck for him. Pa must be watching over him. The thought of Pa almost brings his adrenaline down. All the kids think they are Pa's favorite, but he knows he is. After all, Pa always told the story about his birth and the dragon to everyone. Thinking of Pa takes his breath away. There is such pain in his heart, and the burden is too heavy to handle. He cannot run away from it. His pining for our father is unbearable. But he is the man of the house now, and cannot speak openly of his suffering. Something wet and salty drips into his mouth, focusing him again on his mission. He realizes it is his own tears,
and he lifts up his shirt to quickly wipe his eyes. He misses Pa so much, but he cannot allow himself to think of this now. He has to take care of the family. He is 12 years old and only stands as tall as Ma's shoulders, but he knows he is strong. He has to be. He has no choice. Gek's face floats into his mind, and he fears for her. He sees her hollow eyes and her protruding stomach as she loses more and more strength each day. He hears her cries when she begs Ma to give her food. He sees Ma tell Gek time and time again that there is no food. He doesn't know how long she will live if he doesn't do this. This little bit of food he's able to bring to her prolongs her life just a little more, keeping her with us just a little longer. The images fuel his anger, pushing him nearer and nearer to the cornfields. The clouds grow darker and bigger in the sky, and seconds later he feels droplets of rain on his arms. Suddenly it seems as though the whole sky has opened up and pours down the tears of every Cambodian, drenching him to the skin. In some ways the rain is a blessing, as it lightens the humidity in the air. He remembers how he used to read that in some countries the rain is cold and makes you sick, forcing people to stay indoors. Not so in Cambodia. Here the rain is warm, and in Phnom Penh it meant it was time to go outside and play. The rain was, and still remains, our friend, even under the Khmer Rouge. Then he sees the field ahead of him. It is thick with stalks of corn, each with 3 or 4 ears, standing twice the size of the small boy. His eyes scan the area all around him. His heart beats faster, this time out of anger. Why are the killers starving us when all this is available? His adrenaline is pumping now, and with forced courage he runs from his hiding place into the cornfield. Raindrops splatter on the leaves of the stalks all around him, splashing into his eyes, but he does not care. He picks the first ear off the stalk, hurriedly shucks it, and buries his teeth into it. The sweet, nourishing juices flow out of the corner of his mouth onto his shirt. After he fills his stomach, his fingers work busily to fill the bags. He is so busy that he does not hear the footsteps running in his direction. His heart stops when 2 hands grab him from behind and throw him to the ground. The rain has made the ground all muddy, and he slips as he tries to get back on his feet. Through his wet eyelashes, he sees 2 Khmer Rouge soldiers, their rifles slung across their backs. One soldier grabs him by the arm and pulls him off the ground, but his knees buckle. His head spins. He is shivering with cold and an ever-increasing terror. A hand slaps him hard on the face, making his ears ring. The pain is sharp and cutting, but he bites his jaws together to stop its hurt. "Please, Pa," the voice in his mind screams. "Please help me. Don't let them kill me."
"You bastard," they yell at him. "How dare you steal from the Angkor, you worthless shit."
They scream other obscenities at him, but he is too stunned to hear them. More hands push him down.
"Get up!"
They continue to yell. He is on all fours now and following their orders when a hard-booted foot kicks him in the stomach, knocking his breath away. He is in the mud again, gasping for breath. Another foot stomps on his back and pushes his face into the mud. He opens his mouth, gasping for air, but instead chokes on a mouthful of mud. He is sick with terror, and he does not know what to do next. A hand pulls him up by the hair, and a soldier is staring at him.
"Are you ever going to come back and steal anything ever again from the Angkor?"
he asks Keem.
"No, comrade,"
Keem whimpers as blood drips out of his mouth. But that isn't enough for them. More hands and more legs continue their assault on him. The same questions are asked of him, and the same answer is given. Then one soldier takes his rifle off his shoulder and points it at him. Keem cries then, tears pouring out faster than the rain can wash away.
"Please, comrade, spare my life. Don't kill me,"
he begs them, his body trembling. One soldier laughs at him. He is no longer a boy trying to be the man of the house, trying to be brave. wanting to take care of his family. He is just a 12-year-old boy now, looking into the barrel of a rifle.
"Please, comrade, don't kill me. I know I've done a bad thing. I will never do it again."
The soldier stands there, his rifle rigid in his hand. Then he turns the rifle around and smashes its butt into Kim's skull. White pain flashes everywhere in his body as he falls down but dares not cry.
"Please, comrade, don't!"
"Just go," the soldier interrupts him. "Take your bags and go. Don't ever come back, because next time I will shoot your brains out."
Keem rises unsteadily to his feet and limps home. At home, Chu, Ma, Gek, and I sit quietly waiting for Keem to return. "Chu, Keem's really late tonight. I'm worried about him," I say to her. "It's hard to see out there. He's probably lost his way. It's raining pretty hard." Upon hearing me, the night turns black with evil as the wind howls and a thunderstorm cracks its lightning whips above us. Ma quietly tries to calm Gek, who is afraid of the storm. I turn and see Ma put her hands over her mouth to stifle a scream. My gaze turns to the direction where Ma is looking. Against the backdrop of the dark, I see Keem's 12-year-old body leaning against the door. In his hand are two empty, rain-soaked bags. He is drenched from the rain, but I see the unmistakable color of blood on his clothes and marks on his muddy face. His eyes are half-closed, he is shaken, but he does not cry. Ma rushes over to him and gently touches his wounded face. She cries over his cut, swollen lips and cringes as she touches the blood dripping from his skull.
"My poor little monkey, my poor little monkey, look what they have done to you. They have hurt you, my poor little monkey."
Keem is quiet and does not resist Ma's help taking off his wet shirt. I bite my lip at seeing my brother's body so badly beaten. Raw red marks and painful bruises are everywhere on his ribcage and back. I want to rush over to him to take away his pain, but instead I stand numb in the corner of the room. I see the pain in his face and feel the heaviness in his heart at not being able to bring us food. I stand in my corner with more conviction than ever to kill these soldiers, to avenge the blood that drips from my brother's skull. Someday, I will kill them all. My hatred for them is boundless. It was raining too hard and I did not hear them coming.
"My poor monkey, they hurt you."
"They hit me on the head with the butt of their rifles." Keem finishes telling us his story, and still he does not cry. He flinches when Ma puts a wet rag on his bruised and bleeding head.
"I am sorry I didn't get us any corn tonight," he says to all of us as he lays down, closes his eyes, and falls asleep.
Fearing he might die, and I will not know about it, I walk over to him every few minutes and put my hand under his nose to feel his breath.
"Pa?"
I call quietly.
"Pa, don't let Keem die. Pa, I feel so bad. All this for corn to feed us. Pa, I am bad because I am also sad that we have no corn."
Crouching beside Keem, I squeeze my stomach with my hands, trying to chase the pain away.
"Pa, I am going to kill them all. I am going to make them suffer."
My head hurts, and I press my index fingers against my temples to try and stop the explosion. The stronger my anger, the more I am overcome with feelings of sadness and despair.
"I can't die, Pa. There's nothing we can do but go on living. But one day, they will all suffer as we are suffering now."
After that night, Keem never stole again. These days, he is quieter and more withdrawn. With Pa gone and my older brothers at their camp, Keem is the man of the house. But in reality, he is only a little boy. A little boy who feels helpless and unable to protect his own family. Leaving home. May 1977. 1 month has gone by since Keem was caught stealing corn.
The Ankar has increased our food ration, and as a result, fewer and fewer people are dying from starvation. Those who have survived the famine are slowly getting stronger. It seems as if every 3 months the Khmer Rouge has either increased or decreased our food ration without warning or explanation. For 2 or 3 months we have food to eat, just enough to keep us alive, then nothing to eat for another few months. Then we have a little bit of food again. Keem speculates that it has to do with the rumors of the Yuans, the Vietnamese, attacking the borders. Every time the Ankar thinks the Yuans will invade Cambodia, the soldiers stock up on food and supplies and ship more rice to China in exchange for guns. When it turns out the Yuans are not attacking us, the Ankar stops buying arms and our rations increase. Even without the pressure to find food for us, Keem is different now, and not like the brother I remember from Phnom Penh. He is quieter and rarely says more than a few words. We are all different now. Chu and I have stopped fighting, and Gek, who also has become more and more withdrawn, has stopped asking for Pa. Ma, though, still sits many nights at the door waiting for Pa to return. Though I am sad, and many days wish I am dead, my heart continues to beat with life. My eyes well up at the thought of Pa. "I miss you so much, Pa," I whisper to him. "It is so hard to live without you. I am so sick of missing you." It is hopeless, because no amount of tears will bring him back. I know Pa does not want me to give up, and as hard as it is to endure life here day to day, there is nothing for me to do but go on. Strange things are going on in the village, as entire families disappear overnight. Keem says the Khmer Rouge terror has taken a new toll. The soldiers are executing the entire families of those whom they've taken away, including young children. The Ankar fears the survivors and children of the men they have killed will rise up one day and take their revenge. To eliminate this threat, they kill the entire family. We believe this to be the fate of another one of our neighbors, the Sarin family. The Sarin family lived a few huts down from us. Like our family, the soldiers also took the father, leaving behind the mother and their 3 young kids. The kids are our age, ranging from 5 to 10 years old. A few nights back we heard loud cries coming from their direction. Their cries continued for many minutes, then all was quiet again. In the morning I walked to their hut and saw that they were no longer there. Everything they owned was still in the hut. The small pile of black clothes in the corner of the room, the red-checked scarves, and their wooden food bowls. It has been maybe 3 days now, and still the hut stands empty. It is as if the family magically disappeared, and no one dares to question their whereabouts. We all pretend not to notice their disappearance. When she returns from work one evening, Ma hurriedly gathers Keem, Chu, Gek, and me together, saying she has something to tell us. With all of us sitting in a circle waiting for her, Ma nervously walks around the hut outside to make sure no one can hear us. When she joins us, her eyes are filled with tears.
"If we stay together, we will die together,"
she says quietly.
"But if they cannot find us, they cannot kill us."
Her voice shakes when she speaks.
"You 3 have to leave and go far away. Gek is 4 and too young to go. She will stay with me."
Her words stab my heart like 1,000 daggers.
"You 3 will each go in different directions. Keem, you go to the south. Chu will head to the north and Luang to the east. Walk until you come to a work camp. Tell them you are orphans and they will take you in. Change your name. Don't even tell each other your new names. Don't let people know who you are."
Ma's voice grows stronger with determination as the words pour out.
"This way, if they catch one of you, they cannot get to the rest because you will have no information to give them. You will have to leave tomorrow morning before anyone else is up."
Her mouth says many more words to us, but I cannot hear them. Fear creeps its way into my body, making it tremble. I want to be strong and fearless, to show Ma she does not have to worry about me. "I don't want to go," I blurt the words out.
Ma looks at me firmly.
You have no choice, she says.
The next morning, Ma comes to wake me, but I am already up. Chu and Keem are dressed and ready to go. Ma packs my one pair of clothes, wraps my food bowl in a scarf, and ties it diagonally around my back. Slowly, I climb down the steps to where Chu and Keem are waiting for me.
Remember, Ma whispers, don't go together, and don't come back.
My heart sinks as I realize Ma really is sending us away. Ma, I'm not going! I plant my feet to the ground, refusing to move.
Yes, you are,
Ma says sternly.
Your pa is gone now, and I just cannot take care of you kids. I don't want you here. You are too much work for me. I want you to leave.
Ma's eyes stare at us blankly. Ma! My arms reach out to her, pleading with her to take me back into her arms and tell me I can stay. But she swats them back with a quick slap.
Now go!
She turns me around by the shoulders and bends down to give me a hard swat on the butt, pushing me away. Keem is already walking away from us with his eyes looking ahead and his back rigid. Chu follows slowly behind him, her sleeves continuously wiping her eyes. Reluctantly, I drag myself away from Ma and catch up with them. After a few steps, I turn around and see that Ma has already gone back into the hut. Gek sits at the door, watching us leave. She lifts her hand and waves to me silently. We have all learned to be silent with our emotions. The farther I am away from the village, the more my anger overtakes my sadness. Instead of missing Ma, my blood boils with resentment toward her. Ma doesn't want me around anymore. Pa took care of us and kept us together. Ma cannot do this because she is weak, like the Ankar says. The Ankar says women are weak and dispensable. I was Pa's favorite. Pa would have kept me home. Ma has Gek. She has always had Gek. She loves Gek. It is true that Gek is too young to leave, but I am not yet 8. I have nobody. I am completely alone. The sun climbs to the backs of our heads, scorching them. The gravel path burns and digs into the soles of my feet and breaks through the hard calluses. I move off the gravel to walk on the grass. June is only the beginning of the rainy season, so the grass is still plump and green. In November, the grass will shrivel up and become sharp like pins. The soles of my feet are so thick and calloused that not even the pin grass can cut through them. However, when the grass is tall, like it is now, the blades cut my skin like paper. It has been a long time since I have worn shoes. I don't remember when I stopped. I think it was when we arrived in Rolip that they burned my red dress. In Phnom Penh, I had black buckle shoes that went with my school uniform. The soldiers burned those, too. Soon it is time for Keem to go off on his own path. He stops us and again repeats Ma's instructions without emotion. Although he is only 12, his eyes have the look of an old man. Without words of goodbye or good luck, he turns and walks away from us. I want to run to him and put my arms around him, hold him the way I held Pa and Cave in my mind. I don't know if or when I will ever see him again. I don't want to bear the sadness of missing him. With my hands clenched into fists by my sides, I stand there and my eyes follow his body until I can no longer see him. Though it goes against Ma's warnings, Chu and I cannot separate ourselves, so we head off in the same direction. With no food or water, we walk in silence all through the morning as the sun beats down on us. Our eyes look everywhere for signs of human life, but find none. All around us the trees are brown, their green leaves, wilted in the heat of the white sky, hang quietly on the branches. The only sound comes from our feet and the pebbles that roll away from our toes. As the sun climbs above our heads, our stomachs grumble in unison, asking for food, which of course we don't have. In silence, Chu and I follow the red dirt trail, winding and stretching before us. As our bodies grow tired and weak, we long to sit and rest in the shade, but we force ourselves on. We do not know where or when our trail will end.
It is afternoon when we finally see a camp. The camp consists of 6 straw-roofed huts, very much like ours, except they are longer and wider. Opposite them are 2 open huts that are used as the communal kitchen and 3 smaller huts where the supervisors live. The camp is surrounded by huge vegetable gardens on all sides. In one, about 50 young children squat in a row, pulling weeds and planting vegetables. Another 50 children lined up at the wells are in the process of watering the gardens. Buckets of water are passed from one person to another. The last person with the bucket pours the water onto the garden and runs the bucket back to the well. Standing at the gate, we are greeted by the camp supervisor. She is as tall as Ma, but much bigger and more intimidating. Her black hair is cut chin-length and square, the same style as the rest of us. From her large, round face, her black eyes peer at us. "What are you doing here?"
"Mae Bong, my sister and I are looking for a place to live."
In Khmer, I address the supervisor as Comrade Elder Sister, with as much strength in my voice as I can muster.
"This is a children's work camp. Why are you not living with your parents?"
"Mae Bong, our parents died a long time ago. We are orphans and have been living with different families, but they no longer want us."
My heart races with guilt as the lies spill out of my mouth. In the Chinese culture, it is believed that if you speak of someone's death out loud, it will come true. By telling the comrade's sister my parents are dead, I have put a marker on Ma's grave.
"Did they die at the re-education camp?"
Mae Bong asks. I hear Chu's gasp for breath and warn her not to say anything with my eyes.
"No, Mae Bong. We were farmers living in the countryside. I was too young to remember, but I know they died fighting for the Civil War."
I am amazed how easily the lies come out of my mouth. Mae Bong seems to believe the lies, or maybe she simply does not care. She is in charge of 100 kids and does not care if her workforce is increased by 2 more.
"How old are you and your sister?"
"I am 7 and she is 10.
"All right, come in."
This is a girls' camp for those who are considered too weak to work in the rice fields. We are considered useless because we cannot help out the war effort directly. Yet from morning till night we work in the scorching sun, growing food for the army. From sunrise to sunset we plant crops and vegetables in the garden, stopping for only dinner and lunch. Each night we fall into an exhausted sleep, wedging closely together on a wooden bamboo plank with 50 other girls, the other 50 in another hut. Nothing at the camp is wasted, especially water. The well water is strictly for the gardens and cooking. To wash ourselves and our clothes, we must walk a mile to the pond. After a long day of roasting in the sun, no one is thrilled about the walk for a wash, so we rarely bathe. Everything is collected and reused. Old clothes become scarves, old food is dried and saved, and human waste is remixed as topsoil. After our first evening meal, Chu and I are told to gather around the bonfire for nightly lessons. When we get there, we see that all the other children are already there. We squat on the ground waiting for the Mae Bong to read the latest news or propaganda from the Angkor. In a voice full of fury and adulation, Mae Bong yells out, "Angkor is all-powerful! Angkor is the savior and liberator of the Khmer people!" Then 100 children erupt into 4 fast claps, their fisted arms raised to the sky, and scream, "Angkor! Angkor! Angkor!" Chu and I follow suit, though we do not understand the propaganda of what Mae Bong is saying. "Today the Angkor soldiers drove away our enemy, the hated Yuan, out of our country."
"Angkor! Angkor! Angkor!"
"Though there are many more Yuans than Khmer soldiers, our soldiers are stronger fighters and will defeat the Yuans, thanks to the Angkor."
"Angkor! Angkor! Angkor!"
"You are the children of the Angkor. Though you are weak, the Angkor still loves you. Many people have hurt you, but from now on the Angkor will protect you." Every night we gather to hear such news and propaganda, and are told of how the Angkor loves us and will protect us. Every night I sit there and imitate their movements, while hatred incubates inside me, growing larger and larger. Their Ankar may have protected them, but it never protected me. It killed Cave and Pa. Their Ankar does not protect me when the other children bully Chu and me. The children despise me and consider me inferior because of my light skin. When I walk by them, my ears ring from their cruel words, and their spit eats through my skin like acid. They throw mud at me, claiming it will darken my ugly white skin. Other times they stick their legs out and trip me, causing me to fall and scrape my knees. Mei Bong always turns the other way. At first I do nothing and take their abuse silently, not wanting to attract any attention to myself. Each time I fall, I dream of breaking their bones. I have not survived this much to be defeated by them. While washing up for dinner one evening, one of the bullies, Ronnie, walks up and pinches my arm. "Stupid Chinese Yuan," she hisses at me. My face burns and my blood boils with hatred. As if possessed by a will of their own, my arms reach for her neck and my hands close around her throat, squeezing hard. Her face turns white with confusion. She gasps for air, chokes under the pressure of my fingers. She grabs my arms, her nails scratching my skin. I refuse to let go. Sharp pain explodes on my shin as she kicks me. My anger makes me feel 6 feet tall, and I lunge at her with my body, knocking her to the ground. Sitting on her chest, my eyes pierce hers. My hands slap her face. I yell, "Die! Die!" Ronnie's eyes widen with fear as blood pours out of her nose and stains my hands. Still, I cannot stop. I want to see her dead. "Die! I hate you! I am going to kill you!" My small fingers wrap themselves around her throat again, trying to squeeze out her life. I hate her. I hate them all. Two hands grab me by my arms, twisting them painfully back. Another set of hands grabs my hair, pulling it back, dragging me off Ronnie. Still, I struggle to free myself, my feet kicking dust in her face. "I'm going to kill you!" I scream at her as a large hand slaps my cheek, sending me to the ground. "Enough!" Mei Bong screams. "There will be no killing tonight!" "She attacked me first," Ronnie, sitting up, points at me. "I don't care who started it." She points to Ronnie. "Go and wash up." She then turns to me. Her eyes bore into me. She leans toward me and yells, "You are so strong to get into a fight? You have to water this whole garden tonight. You cannot sleep until you finish. And no food for you tonight." Before leaving, Mei Bong instructs another girl to guard me and make sure I do as I am told. As I struggle to get up, the crowd around me slowly dissipates. Chu comes over and offers her hand, but I refuse it. I grab the water pail and start to water the garden. I work while the girls eat their dinner, recite propaganda at the nightly lessons, and get ready to go to bed. I do not cry, scream, or beg for mercy. I occupy my mind with thoughts of revenge and massacre. In my head, I make a list of all the wrongs done to me. I will make them suffer twice the blows I've suffered by their hands. Many hours into the night, Mei Bong approaches and tells me to go to sleep. Without looking at her, I drop my pail and walk in my hut to fall into an exhausted sleep. The girls stop abusing me after the fight with Ronnie, but they continue to pick on Chu because she looks weak and shows her fear. It has been 3 weeks since Chu and I arrived at the camp. Trailing behind a group of girls, carrying our spare set of black pajama clothes in our hands, we walk to the river for our first wash. "Chu, don't let them beat you up. Don't let them think they can get away with it," I tell her. "But they can beat me and get away with it. I cannot win against them." "So what? I can take any one of them, but if they gang up on me, they can beat me. I don't let them know that. I don't care if I win, but I will draw blood. I will get in my punches." "Chu, I dream of the day when we have power again. I will come back for them. I will get them back and beat them until I am tired. I won't forget. Not ever."
Why would you want to remember? I dream of the day when things are nice again, and I can leave all this behind. Chu does not understand. I need the new memories that make me angry to replace the old ones that make me sad. My rage makes me want to live just to come back and take my revenge. At the pond, the girls run into the water still fully dressed, splashing and laughing at each other's attempt to swim. While Chu scrubs the grime off her clothes, I float face up in the water. Thinking of Cave, I allow myself to sink as the water laps over my cheeks, eyes, and nose. Rising above the surface again, I feel the week's mud dissolve and slide off my skin, my nails, the creases in my neck and toes. The water washes away the dirt, but it will never put out the fire of hate I have for the Khmer Rouge. Child Soldiers, August 1977. The months pass, and the government continues to increase our food ration, allowing me to grow a little stronger. It has been 3 months since we left Roh Leap and last saw Keem, Ma, and Gek. I think about them every day and wonder how they are. At night, when all the other children are fast asleep, Chu and I whisper to each other about Ma and Gek. I hope that Meng, Khoi, and Keem are able to visit Ma and make sure she is well. My heart lifts a little, knowing that Ma has Gek to keep her from being too lonely. The other children have stopped picking on me because I am a fighter. While I have also improved my reputation as a worker, because she is weak, Chu has been taken out of the garden and demoted to a cook. She actually likes it better because she no longer has to associate with the other children. But since I am strong, it was only after 3 months of being at the camp when Mei Bong told me she had some good news. You are the youngest girl here, but you work harder than everyone else. The Angkor needs people like you, she says and smiles. It's really too bad you are not a boy, she adds. When she sees that I am not jumping with joy at the news, her face scowls. Your number one duty is to the Angkor and no one else. You should be happy with yourself. This camp is for the weaklings. The camp you are going to is for the bigger, stronger children. There you will be trained as a soldier so you can soon help fight the war. You will learn many more things there than the children here. Her face beams with pride when she finishes. Yes, Mei Bong, I am happy to go, I lie. I don't understand Mei Bong's elation. I do not want to sacrifice for the country that killed my pa. At the break of dawn, I pack my clothes and my food bowl. Chu stands beside me with her head down. I do not want to leave Chu behind, but I cannot refuse the assignment. Hooking our elbows together, we walk to the gate to meet Mei Bong. Chu, you're older than me. Stop being so weak, I whisper as we hug, our arms wrapped tightly around each other. We will always be sisters, even though you were found in a trash can. Chu cries harder, her tears wetting my hair. Mei Bong breaks our bond and tells me it's time to go. Chu refuses to let go of my hand. With all my strength, I pull it from her grasp and run away. Though my heart aches, I do not look back. Mei Bong leads me to another camp an hour's walk away. I do not know what to expect of the new camp, but when Mei Bong says it is a child soldier training camp, I presume it will be a big place with many weapons and soldiers living there. But the new camp is almost identical to the old one. It is supervised by another Mei Bong with similar features and characteristics, who is just as zealous a believer in the Angkor as my previous supervisor. While they talk, I am left alone to contemplate my new home. The new work camp sits at the edge of a rice field and is surrounded by forest. All around the huts, tall palm trees sway lightly in the wind. In one, a young boy is cutting down a cluster of palm fruits with a silver cleaver.